I thought I'd start this program of Intentions to Serve with something that has nothing to do with intentions to serve. But it is by Woody Allen, and I found it, and I just loved it. And I wanted to share that with you just to kind of breathe a little bit. He says, "In my next life, I want to live my life backwards. You start out dead, and get that out of the way." You can just hear him doing this. You know? Then you wake up in an old people's home, feeling better every day. You get kicked out for being too healthy. Go collect your pension, and then when you start work, you get a gold watch and a party on your first day. You work for 40 years until you're young enough to enjoy your retirement. You party, drink alcohol, and are generally promiscuous. Then you are ready for high school. Then you go to primary elementary school. You become a kid, and you play. You have no responsibilities. You become a baby until you are born. And then you spend your last 9 months floating in a luxurious spa-like conditions with central heating and room service on tap. And you get larger quarters every day. And then, voila, you finish off with a beautiful Accord moment. Cool. I love it. Okay. Well, we're going to have this isn't exactly audience participation, but I have a number of quotes regarding service that are by pretty, you know, people that we know really well. And so what I'm wondering about is name that person with this quote, all right? Just an idea. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in service of others. Ooh, she's coming up. Hold that one. Mahatma Gandhi. Okay. At the end of life, we will not be judged by how many diplomas we have received, how much money we have, how many great things we have done. We will be judged by, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was naked and you clothed me. I was homeless and you took me in. That's it. Okay. This must have been a hint. This must have been earlier in his administration. Sorry. The best way to not feel hopeless is to get up and do something. Don't wait for good things to happen to you. If you go out and make some good things happen, you will fill the world with hope. You will fill yourself with hope. Barack Obama. Barack Obama. Every day can be great because anyone can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and verb agree to serve. You only need a heart full of grace, a soul generated by love. Martin Luther King. That was Martin Luther King. You are what you do, not what you say you'll do. Is that good? That's a hard one, but that's Carl Jung, for psychologist. Here's one for the business world. I've come to believe that each of us has a personal calling that's as unique as a fingerprint, and that the best way to succeed is to discover what you love and then find a way to offer it to others in the form of service, working hard, and also allowing the energy of the universe to lead you. Oprah. Get that. Gold stars out here. I only have a couple more. Don't worry, this won't go on much longer. this is a little hard one. It's a little more difficult to place this one. He's well known, but you probably haven't heard from him for a long time, because I think he died a long time. But as long as we love, we serve. So long as we are loved by others, I would almost say that we are indispensable, and no man or woman is useless when he or she has a friend. Robert Louis Stevenson from Les Marbles. It's a good one. And finally, this one is also obscure, but I really liked it. If you don't live a life in service of a greater good, you got to at least die a death in service of a greater good. And I fear that I won't get either a life or a death that means anything. Right, that would have been good. Yeah, good guess. Yeah. That was John Green from The Fault in Our Stars. Not Patton, but I bet he thought of it at some point. John Green from The Fault of Our Stars. Okay. Well, that was fun. Okay. This is going to be divided into three parts. I'm going to make three points and three. And they're not really going to, I don't know how tightly they're going to blend together, but I thought that all of them were important to address when it comes to intentions of service, as well as service in general, specifically volunteerism. And the first point is how we measure the extent of volunteerism, how it's done, and why it is so not right. The Bureau of Labor Statistics recently has reported that the volunteer rate in America has decreased and has a trend in decreasing last year by 1% from 24.4% of Americans. So from 2012 and 2013, this has a giant impact on thousands of community organizations that rely on volunteers to fulfill their missions. Any dip in the volunteer rate is a cause for concern. So about a quarter of Americans on the books volunteer. Right. Doesn't to me sound like all that many, when you really get down to it. But the BLS report at its core may not mean that Americans' commitment to volunteering is waning. Instead, the data may suggest an evolution in how Americans volunteer. When Winter Storm Leon, I didn't even know winter storms had names, but the one in Atlanta a few months ago, an army of concerned citizens sprang to life. They grabbed shovels to rescue motorists stranded on the gridlocked icy roads. They grabbed chainsaws to free people trapped in their homes by falling tree limbs. But Michelle Solicito did something different. She grabbed a laptop and helped hundreds of people get home safely right from her kitchen table. When Sausalito's Facebook group Snowed Out Atlanta amassed 50,000 members overnight and helped orchestrate hundreds of rescues, she was called a visionary and maybe even a heroine. Michelle Solicito found a way to deliver impact without ever leaving her home. But you couldn't call her a volunteer, at least not in the traditional definition. And that points to a powerful need for change. The Bureau of Labor Statistics relies on a traditional definition of volunteering: unpaid work performed for third-party organizations, which may not take into account several of the recent booming trends in volunteerism. First, number one, the explosion of pro bono and skill-based volunteer service. More and more companies and individuals are finding ways to volunteer their skills and their talents. Just last year, more than 500 companies pledged $2 billion worth of skill-based and pro bono volunteer service that could go uncounted under a traditional definition of volunteering. The rise in online servicing, that's number two. Okay. Volunteering used to be exclusively about lending your hands and feet. but increasingly it's about lending your tweets. Today's younger volunteers in particular perform acts of service every day, whether they use the social network to rack up millions of views for civic-minded videos or drive fundraising for people in need through online platforms such as GoFundMe and HobMob. Traditionalists have labeled online volunteering and engagements, and I really have a hard time with the labeling of things, but volunteer engagement as slackivism. Because, you know, you can't complete your service, you know, from your couch in your pajamas, right? You have to be out there getting your hands dirty. Maybe not. But as the service movement evolves, I think it's important to acknowledge that in many cases, the greatest asset a volunteer may be able to offer is his or her ability to quickly mobilize thousands of Facebook friends or Twitter followers to raise awareness or dollars and to inspire action. Number three, the increase in youth and youth adult volunteering. While the BLS data indicates that 16 to 34-year-olds are the least likely to volunteer in traditional ways, we know from lots of other research that this demographic group is highly engaged and civic-oriented. The 25 to 34 demographic creates more online petitions than any other age group, such as onchange.org, which is a popular online activism platform. And we see an increase in volunteering by those too young to be measured by the BLS statistics. Remember, they only start at age 16. In just a few weeks last December, tens of thousands of even younger people acted to help one another so Hasbro could donate $1 million worth of toys and games to Toys for Tots. And finally, number four, the number of people using their purchasing power to support causes. Many realtors are sending some or all of their profits to nonprofits. Research shows that more than half, or 54%, of consumers bought a product with a social or environmental benefit in the past year. None of this is included in the BLS report and data. By any definition, the impact of today's volunteers is surely at an all-time high. We're just using a very outdated way of measuring it. So besides all the numbers, what is also important is that we are finding more creative and proactive ways to provide service with the same good intentions, just maybe in a different way, or maybe different ways. Point number two, the true intentions of service. Many of the quotes I mentioned before had a kind of similar theme. The intent to serve or provide a service must be genuine and must not be for your own need or gain. Now, I'm going to challenge that just a little bit, and there's a reason for it. I think it's helpful to start a discussion on the intentions to service with the basic but true premise that real service does not happen unless both people, the one providing the service and the one receiving it, are being served. Okay. So what that means is two things, being selfless and selfish. All right. According to Frank Ostaneski, he's a founding director of Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco, he attended an installation ceremony at the Zen Center. A student asked, an abbot at the ceremony, "What can the Dharma teach me about serving others?" The abbot answered, "What others? Serve yourself." The student persisted, "How do I serve myself?" To which the abbot responded, "By serving others." At the very heart of service, it's important to understand that the act of caring is always mutually beneficial. Those who provide service to others understand that in nurturing others, they are always caring for themselves as well. They may not even really know it or admit it. And this understanding fundamentally shifts the way care is provided. According to Ostrowski, when I am in a situation where someone needs my help, I'm not the good guy coming to the rescue. I have no white horse. Instead, I become what I call a compassionate companion. Compassion, when literally translated, means suffering with others. And with is the important word there because it implies belonging. And you know how much we love the word belonging. Companion is one who travels with another. That's how it's defined. So in this relationship, there is no guide, there is no healer, and no one is healed. We simply accompany one another. And often, that's the best thing that can be done. Now, I do education programs for caregivers at UTMB with my geriatric center. And these are caregivers, many of them, you know, care for those that have a loved one with Alzheimer's disease or a disability. And it's amazing to see really dedicated people, such as a spouse, who will be there day after day providing care, for example, for his wife, as she slowly slips away in mind and spirit and eventually body. Is overwhelming for many, and those who do it best, they reach out to others and know this is what I need to do for my wife. But maybe deep down, they're also thinking it's also what I need to do for me. So too often in caregiving, we may not so much be looking to see what serves, but to confirm some idea we have about ourselves. We want to be somebody. We say, such as in hospice care, I work with the dying, with the emphasis on I, and invest in that role, not in the function. Ostrowski calls these helper's disease, and it is much more rampant, such as in epidemics of AIDS or cancer. We try to set ourselves apart from other people's suffering. We set ourselves apart through our pity, our fear, our professional warmth, and even our charitable acts. Now, this isn't everybody. This happens. But this work really has nothing to do with charity. Rachel Remen, who runs the Commonwealth Cancer Center in California, says, service is not the same as helping. Helping is based on inequality. It is not a relationship between equals. When you help, you use your own strength to help someone with less strength. It's a one-up and one-down relationship, and people feel this inequality. When we help, we may inadvertently take away more than we give, diminishing the person's sense of self-worth and self-esteem. I'm not exactly sure I agree with that. I see where that's coming from. And it's a tough thing to really grasp and hold on to and feel that, oh, is this really what helping's about? So the point really is that the intention to serve, of course, is selfless. But it requires that we also are selfish in that we need to know that it is important what we're doing, not just for those who provide the service or who is provided the service to, but because I, the server, am also being provided a necessary service. A few years ago, when I was more involved with other things besides music and in this fellowship, I tried to develop a caring committee. And it was based on a model from the Bay Area Unitarian Universalist Church in Clear Lake, where I was a member for a while and knew people. And I got to say that it didn't quite work the way I wanted it to. And I couldn't understand why. I couldn't understand. I had the best intentions of this thing, you know, reaching the needs of this fellowship. I was selfless. I had the compassion. I was selfish. And that gave me the motivation to get it to work. So what was missing? Communication and organizational skills. It was great having that really good intentions of doing this great thing for our fellowship and that it would work. But I didn't know how to get from A to B, you know, in terms of letting people know what we needed to do. As opposed to now, that we have an amazing caring committee led by Claudia and that wonderful group, and it has all the ingredients, which is why it will work, and that it does work. I know there's Carol, right, exactly. And so that's one example, which is why now I think I'm much happier doing music. Because first, it's truly what I think I like to do for people, to help them appreciate music and how music gets the spirit going. Okay, that's my selfless side. Selfishly, I like to show that I could play something and that I enjoy it. You know, and it's true. You know, I love being up there doing a song and knowing that hopefully people will like it. And I'm a little better with the skill set, you know, in terms of communicating how and what I want to play. And, of course, my organization with my wonderful wife, Bunny, has added an amazing ingredient to the music we play. And I'm very thankful to be able to do that. So the intentions are there in terms of selflessness and selfishness. Okay. Third point, the joy of losing your story. A very common thing that happens in conversation is when we begin to drift, especially if it's not necessarily very interesting. And we are busy doing lots of other things, and oh gosh, I gotta go. Do we take the time to really listen to those close to us? Never mind those who come across like our neighbors, for example. We don't really know very well. Do we really listen? Anthony Cirillo, he's a social worker and president of Fast Forward Counseling. He's a health care expert. He works with caregivers. He gives talks. He's an advocate for the elderly. He works in long-term care facilities in an area of resident experience as strategic marketing. He's one of my favorite people for a lot of reasons. He's Italian. He's a musician. He plays at these long-term care facilities. And most of all, he's a social worker who understands caregiving. And he tells the story that whenever my sister calls, she talks too much. She goes on and on about irrelevant information, and we extend phone calls way farther than they should be. As a result of that, I tune her out, damaging our relationship. In fact, my fine art of tuning out got so bad that I missed 80% of the details surrounding our recent trip and visit at Thanksgiving. I realized that at some point we probably did have a few conversations where that really did happen. I tuned her out. But then I made it in my mind for every conversation that it would not be that way. That it was because I was so much into my own story while talking to her. I wasn't listening. When I apologized to her, I made a commitment to start fresh and engage in our conversations. I look at some deliberate steps to make sure that I'm a better listener. Not talking to her when also on the computer or while driving or playing on my iPad. Now when she calls, I pay attention. I listen, I ask questions, and as a result, our relationship has deepened. To do that, I had to break a cycle, and by losing my story while talking and listening to her, I opened up room for many new possibilities. In an ideal world, we would work on losing our story. That's holding on to maybe a past or defined future. Instead, we would approach each situation in a moment and open it to the possibilities. Now, I guarantee I could look at a person and get an idea of whether I'm getting through with conversation or whether they're off somewhere else. Well, there are lots of examples out there. For example, physicians speak emphatically to a patient, and how authentic is that? You know, and they have 15 minutes to be genuine, and meanwhile they're on their 25th patient of the day. It's got to be hard to do that. So is there a little internal voice in the situation, the moment, that they can say, yes, I'm really concentrating and listening to what this patient needs? So short of losing our story, we must realize that most everyone lives in a world of context. Whether it is an administrator working with a physician or a marketer with a consumer, we need to be aware of what the context is so that we can relate to people from a common language. Perhaps if we first look on how we communicate and relate to each other, we can move on to losing our stories. Because by doing the former, communicating better, we will learn new things about each other, and that will show the irrelevance of our own story. I'd like to end with a final quote, very short. You can maybe guess who this is from, too. The simple path, silence is prayer, prayer is faith, faith is love, love is service, the fruit of service is peace. That would have been good. There's Mother Teresa. I didn't know that she talked so much. Really, I thought she just did stuff, and all of a sudden there's quotes all over from her. Who knew? But anyway, that ends. So be it.